This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Sharon Farrell. This is the Words at Large podcast, a look at the world of books on CBC Radio. Vanishing Species, The Underground Railroad, Gun Culture in Canada, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and Personal Stories of AIDS in Africa. This year's nominees for the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction covers a lot of ground. They address a world getting out of hand and consider how to tackle those issues. Today on the podcast, we'll take a look at each of them. Last month, American rapper T.I. was arrested for attempting to illegally purchase machine guns. It happened just before the multi-platinum musician was scheduled to perform at the BET Music Awards. For some people, the arrest was just another in a long line of incidents, and yet more evidence of the link between hip-hop and gun culture. But is that the whole story? One of the nominees of this year's Governor General's Literary Awards takes a deep look at both. The title of the book is Enter the Babylon System, Unpacking Gun Culture from Samuel Colt to 50 Cent. It investigates both the firearm industry and the environment that legitimizes and glorifies gun culture. Rodrigo Bascunyan and Christian Pierce are co-founders of the hip-hop magazine Pound. They're also the co-authors of Enter the Babylon System. Rodrigo spoke with Brent Bambry on the CBC radio program Q on October 17th.
But you knew when you set out to do this that you were going into a territory that a lot of people hadn't explored, the gun culture from the hip-hop perspective, but with the added influence of the various gun industries. Mm-hmm. And trying to compare which, in fact, is the most corrosive influence on youth and culture.
Well, I mean, I think without a doubt we have to look at the people who are actually making firearms before anything. I mean, I think that should be obvious. You know, going around after the book and doing interviews, and I remember thinking, you know, this the subtitle to the book is From Samuel Colt to 50 Cent, right? Mm-hmm. And Samuel Colt being the inventor of the revolver and 50 Cent being a famous rapper today. But 90% of the interviews were about 50 Cent.
Right.
No one ever asked about Samuel Colt, yet he's the man who is responsible for the creation of the revolver. I mean, how direct of a link do you need to actual death, right? But people don't – those weren't the questions that people were interested in. It was always, you know, what about rap? How is rap involved, you know? And I wasn't surprised by that, but – at the same time, I had hoped that the response would be different to the book.
So did you conclude that there was a lack of assigning the proper responsibility to the parties involved?
Hip-hop's, you know, unfortunately been, you know, the focus of a lot of different problems. You know, a lot of problems have been blamed on hip-hop. So I don't think it's unique that this problem, you know, that some people will try to shirk the blame towards hip-hop, right? I don't think it's unique towards the gun issue, but... again, you know, I always think that there's different reasons why people do it. You know, there's the people who are, you know, truly ignorant and actually believe that something like music is the center of a problem like this. Then there's the people who know what's wrong and just kind of want to, you know, push the blame somewhere else to sort of distract everyone from the real issues,
but,
right?
But people, I mean, I'm sure that people listening are thinking, wait a minute now, what about T.I.? And what about the influence that he has on young kids? Mm-hmm. And what about this sense of glamour and opulence, mm-hmm, that's sold through the lyrics of rap music and, mm-hmm, and to impressionable kids or to kids who don't really have, perhaps in some cases, another outlet?
Yeah, no, I mean, I won't deny, you know, that hip-hop artists, they're not all angels. But at the same time, there have been a lot of cases in the past that looked ironclad from the outside. You know, a few years ago, there was a case against Irv Gotti and his brother, Lorenzo Gotti, who ran Murder, Inc., which is a record label that Ja Rule was on.
Yes.
And, you know, when the case first came out, it was like, oh, this is open and shut. These guys are going to jail forever for embezzling money and for being involved with a big drug dealer in New York City. Well, turned out all of it was completely fabricated. There was nothing there, you know. And this has happened a lot with rap artists. So I think the perception that exists on the outside is only what you get from those initial reports, right? So we don't really know what's going on in this TI case either, right? It's even the information that's come out up to this point is very erroneous. You know, they're saying that he has machine guns and stuff like that, machine guns with silencers, which don't even exist. So I really doubt that that's what he's buying from the very beginning.
Right.
So, you know, people have to be aware of the fact that there is a lot of misinformation out there. No doubt there have been rappers that have been involved in some unsavory things. Mm-hmm. But this is really a reflection of where this music is coming from, right? Being primarily made by people who are coming from the underclass. And the underclass, because of, you know, obvious reasons, is prone to more desperation, which leads to crime and criminal behavior and this type of thing. So they're more closely linked to that world. And just because you become a rapper, it doesn't negate the early part of your life. You don't just leave those links behind and those people you knew. So there's always that proximity to that world.
Guns are not given away with CDs.
No,
The guns come from somewhere. And that market that they come from is supported by an enormous amount of money, some of it legitimate and some of it not legitimate. Mm-hmm. Who is driving the idea or the misinformation that you say is misinformation of scapegoating rap music, mm-hmm. or that particular aspect of rap music when it comes to the problems of gun violence and the really, really huge social ills associated with it?
Well, I mean, recently in U.S. Congress, they had this whole, you know, conference on, you know, is hip hop a problem? You know, do we need to be, you know, look out for the lyrics? And it's unbelievable that they're still doing this after 30 years of history of this music, that they're still meeting Congress to talk about this.
Do you think that the gun lobby or gun manufacturers look at that and are relieved that that's where the finger is pointing?
Well, I think the gun manufacturers are relieved whenever, you know, they're not in the media, right? I mean, their whole stance has always been to just not say anything. You know, the best thing that they can do is remain quiet, and they know that.
What happened when your partner went to when you're writing Babylon System, mm-hmm. Your partner Chris went to interview or wanted to interview the maker of Canadian handguns Para Ordnance in Toronto? What happened there?
Well, when we first started, this was pretty early on in the process. And for those that don't know, Para Ordnance is in Scarborough, and they do make handguns, and they are a major handgun manufacturer, big player in the game. And we approached them to interview them for the book. This is very early on. And, you know, first they sent us sort of a very threatening email saying, you know, govern yourselves accordingly. This is all in the book. I mean, the whole excerpt of the email that they sent us, it was very threatening. And, you know, all that information came out in the end, and it made them look, I think, even worse in the book. But their response has always been just, you know, complete silence. Because, you know, that they know that that's the best thing they can do is never acknowledge what's going on. And
Did they ever send a lawyer your way?
No. Nothing we said was untrue, right? So there's nothing there for them to really attack us on. But I think the simple fact that, you know, the vast majority of the people in Toronto aren't aware of a gun manufacturer in Scarborough. I mean, this isn't far away. It's in Scarborough. Speaks a lot to how well they've done in keeping a low profile.
So what did you think when you heard about the TI case this week?
Again, you know, I mean, there's been so many incidents where the police have picked up rappers for various reasons. Another rapper recently that was arrested in New York was Lil Wayne. And, you know, he originally they were charging him with gun possession. And he said as soon as they brought him into the police station, all they wanted to know was, you know, do you have beef with Jay-Z? Do you have beef with 50 Cent? As if, you know, these are different crime families operating and they should have some underground war going on. And they didn't even really care about anything else he did. They just wanted to sort of get this scoop on this imaginary world that they've created where, you know, every rapper is the head of some criminal family, right? So I'm really, really skeptical of what goes on in the United States when any hip hop artist is arrested.
But you know that there's been incidents, you know, outside of radio stations in New York City where hip hop artists have taken shots at each other taken bullets, and then this becomes a badge of pride, or it seems to escalate the whole image of the bad guy gangster and the idea that they're somehow living a life that's dangerous.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that in the last few years. probably with the emergence of 50 Cent in particular, when he, you know, his story was publicized of him getting shot, you know, that became a selling tool. And I think that's kind of dying down now. I think people are starting to realize this is really ridiculous. Like, what are we really selling here? And it's become a gimmick in itself. But, I mean, for a while, it spoke very badly of the music and what people were interested in.
Are you done with the subject now? Are you going to revisit it? Or are you moving on to the next thing?
I don't know. I remember one day my mom said to me, she's like, maybe subjects like this are a little bit too dark for you, you know, a little too depressing. And I was like, you know, at first I was kind of insulted. I was like, I could handle it. And then I started thinking over time, I'm like, you know, maybe it is a lot to handle. Maybe it is a lot to think about.
So in what direction? What light direction are you looking into now?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, stay in the light, Rodrigo. Thanks for being with us. Congratulations to you and Christian.
Brent Bambry was speaking with author Rodrigo Bascunyan about his book Enter the Babylon System. It's published by Random House and is a nominee for this year's Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. Another nominee for this year's award is Carolyn Smards Frost. Her book, I've Got a Home in Gloryland, tells the story of two fugitive slaves from Kentucky who started Toronto's first taxi company. Frost, an archaeologist and historian, was looking for a site in the Toronto area to run an archaeological dig accessible to children. She found Ingle Nooks School. Exhaustive research uncovered the fact that the site was originally a taxi company run by escaped slaves. 20 years later, Frost has published a book about some of those lost stories. Toronto CBC radio host Andy Berry spoke to her last spring when the book was first published.
What were some of the challenges you had? Well, first of all, of course, you had to do the dig itself, but then you had to uncover the story behind what you found.
It took 20 years. I call it a passion. My husband calls it my obsession. Mm-hmm. And the major challenge was the fact that Thornton and Lucy Blackburn had no children, and they could not read and write. Consequently, within a generation of their deaths, their story was completely forgotten in Toronto, except for the fact that the first cab driver in the city had been a black man named Thornton Blackburn. Mm-hmm.
So could you explain to us, because I think this is a fascinating window into relations between the United States and Canada. It's the 1830s, and there's a serious disagreement as to who owns a person who has previously been a slave but has now escaped into the promised land. Can you just tell us about these riots?
Oh, Thornton and Lucy Blackburn. Mm-hmm. They had escaped from their owners in Louisville, Kentucky, when Mrs. Blackburn had just been sold, I think to be sold as a sex slave down the river to New Orleans. And they came as far as Detroit, and they stayed there for 2 years and did very well. But Thornton was recognized on the street one day by someone from Kentucky, and their story was blown, their cover was blown, and they were arrested. They were jailed, and they were going to be sent back to Kentucky and to their masters. Immediately, the black community of Detroit formed a coalition. They planned a riot. On the first day, which was the Sunday morning, two ladies went into the jail to pray with Mrs. Blackburn. They were very well dressed, had veils over their faces, and when they left weeping into their handkerchiefs with their faces covered. And it wasn't until the next day that it was discovered that one of them was Lucy Blackburn, and her friend had stayed behind the jail in her place. That very afternoon, the slave catchers were, of course, furious. Thornton was brought to the door of the jail, and he was going to be taken down to a cart to take him to the river, to a steamboat to take him back to Kentucky. And the black community of Detroit and some white members of the society, too, who were furious about the idea of somebody being sent into slavery from a free territory, attacked the jail. They grabbed Thornton, threw him into a cart, carried him off in a wild ride down towards the river, but they could hear dogs barking in the background. There was a posse forming. Mm-hmm. So they pulled him out of the cart, broke the manacles on his ankles with an axe, tied handkerchiefs around the chain so they wouldn't rattle, and sent the horse off in a different direction. Got him down to the river, got him across the river to Canada, and there Thornton, the seven young men who had escaped with him, because it was a broad daylight riot, they had to leave town, and his wife were all jailed. The mayor of Detroit had asked the Canadian government to hold them pending an extradition request because they accused them of inciting the very riot which had rescued them.
And they wind up, of course, remaining in Canada. Canada refuses ultimately to hand them over.
In the first piece of public policy decision-making ever made in Canada regarding refugee reception.
Yeah. Wow, isn't that fascinating?
CBC radio host Andy Berry speaking with Carolyn Smards Frost about her book, I've Got a Home in Gloryland, A Lost Tale of the Underground. The book was published by Thomas Allen, and it's one of the nominees for the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. Next up on our list for this year's award is John English for his biography, Citizen of the World, The Life of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Volume 1. A history professor at the University of Waterloo and former Liberal MP, English was given access to some of Trudeau's private letters and journals. They allowed him to offer an in-depth look at not only the privileged early years of Pierre Trudeau's life, but the Quebec that formed him. Last fall, CBC journalist Carol Off spoke to John English about his book on the program As It Happens. Here's some of that interview.
The most striking thing is that you obviously had an enormous access to the papers, to the documents, the letters. It's unbelievable what you had. How did you arrange to have that access?
What happened is after Pierre Trudeau died, his literary executors approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a biography of Trudeau. I hesitated because I'd realized it'd be a large project. And secondly, I had read the Trudeau memoirs, of course, and realized they weren't very thick. There wasn't much detail in them. I assumed that there'd be very little in the way of papers. So what happened was that I talked to the executors and they said there was a large cache of papers in the Trudeau home in Montreal.
Because it's not just letters that he wrote, but drafts after drafts. Yeah. He saved every draft, and then he got letters. He got the letters of people he'd written the letters and got them back again. It's extraordinary what he saved.
Simply put, his mother adored him. She kept every exam paper he wrote, every notebook, every report card, every little thing he sketched out. When his father died, he had written a letter to his father. His mother, and he ripped it up when he was told his father had died, his mother wasn't there. His mother came home, took the paper, and pasted it together and saved it. She was that aware of his unusual qualities, I guess, because she doesn't seem to have done it for her other son. Then Trudeau himself was a perfectionist. He drafted his letters to his girlfriends, sometimes two or three times, drafted his letters to his teachers, to his friends. And because of that, you've got the other side of the letters. What you realize is both sides of the conversation, and you get a sense of the perfectionism of Trudeau, and also the fact that he was, quite frankly, a pack rat.
Mm-hmm. And what before anyone who's listening to this gets the idea that this is you've amassed all this trivia, and who really cares about his early report cards? What's so striking about this book is that it paints a picture of a time and all kinds of characters who would go on to become iconic in political life. You have, you know, people like Jean Drapeau, Jacques Hébert, René Lévesque, even Bourdois, the artist, and all these, a lot of his women friends became iconic figures as well. So what you get from this picture of a time and all the fermented politics of his early years.
It's remarkable. He knew the people who were the dominant figures during the Quiet Revolution and before. He knew the people on both sides of the political divide between separatism and anti-separatism. And as you say, even his girlfriends tended to become very prominent in Quebec society as well. But this is a group that's unusual for an English Canadian because they are intellectuals, they're university professors, they're journalists. Are they ever journalists? And they maintain this connection. They're often connected with the church.
One of the things in one of your footnotes, because actually everyone who's reading this book should know to read all the footnotes because they're quite fascinating. But you write in one of them that the most extraordinary thing you found in the archive was the letters between Trudeau and Therese Gouin, his first real true passionate love affair that was – But again,
you can debate that. But yes.
Well, but the one that he actually is a mature man in his 20s, he had that. And so what was extraordinary about that relationship between those two?
Well, it is an extraordinary relationship for three reasons. One is that she's an extraordinary woman. She has became the Canada's preeminent, I would say, female psychologist, well-known internationally, a woman of great intelligence and charm and distinction. They met when she was young. He was older. He was not that young. He was 25, and he fell in love with her. She seemed to be the perfect partner for him because she was the daughter of a liberal senator, niece of a liberal rebel, famous one, and granddaughter of a Quebec premier and great-granddaughter of a Quebec premier. This is an extraordinary background. But on top of that, she had life and energy and was clearly the most popular girl in her class. The second part about it is they separated because he went off to Harvard, so they had this remarkable correspondence. And they're remarkable because they tell so much about who Pierre Trudeau is. I came to the conclusion in writing about Trudeau and in going through his papers that his confidants were always women. With men, the correspondence is short, to the point, factual usually, very rarely discursive, maybe with a priest sometimes earlier it is, but not afterwards. But with women, it is highly personal, highly emotional, and he simply overflows with his emotions and his opinions about things.
Carol Off speaking with John English in October of 2006 about his book, Citizen of the World, The Life of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Volume 1. It's published by Knopf Canada. Globe and Mail correspondent Stephanie Nolan has published a book called 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. It's another of this year's nomination for the Nonfiction Award. The stories are a blend of hope, despair, tragedy, and the perseverance of the human spirit. AIDS is an overwhelming human tragedy, but in her book, Canadian journalist Stephanie Nolan tells the story of just 28 personal tales, in the hopes of making us care about the staggering epidemic. She spoke with Anna Maria Tremonti on the CBC radio program The Current in April of this year.
Why'd you pick the number 28?
There are 28 million people living with HIV/AIDS in Africa. And it actually came out of an argument with a friend when I was sort of trying to think about how to write this book. And she was saying, you know, it's so big, the numbers are so big, it's so amorphous, you can't kind of get your hands around it. And she said, you know, I just feel like I need a reason to care. And I said, you know, you've got 28 million reasons to care. And she said, well, you know, you need to give me those. And I said, give you 28 million. And she said, no, but you could give me 28. And that's, I said, okay, that's manageable. That I can do.
One for every million.
One for every million.
Now, before you tell us some specific stories, I want to ask about the general story of AIDS in Africa, because you make the point that right into the 90s, this was a crisis no one in the West was even noticing. How can this be?
How can this be? I don't know. I ask myself that all the time. I think still, I mean, into the 90s, people weren't noticing. I would say even today, the lack of attention is not commensurate with the size of the problem. You know, once the Gap makes a T-shirt for an issue, I guess you can't say that nobody's noticing anymore. But certainly, through the 1980s, when the disease was just sort of starting to make news here, it was already killing millions of people in Africa, and there just wasn't the nobody had the facilities to do the kind of diagnostic work to or the surveillance work to piece that together. You had individual doctors who knew, but they weren't talking, who had twigged that this is this thing we're hearing about from America. That must be what this is. This is something new, but they weren't talking to each other. And then through the 1990s, you know, I think that there's this feeling, there was a feeling for a long time, this is just one more disease in a place full of diseases. And yes, this is bad, but other things are bad too. And it took a long time, both within Africa and outside, for people to understand that AIDS was different and that the impact it was having was something different than, you know, than malaria or tuberculosis or things that, of course, were killing people. But that HIV sucked the middle out of societies and totally undermined their ability to cope or respond in a way that had never been seen before.
And that's what we still see today, really.
Yeah. I mean, I've been reporting on this story full time for 4 years now, and things are very different than when I started. But yeah, the rollout of treatment notwithstanding, the reality is that in most places still, it's 17 to 35-year-olds who are infected. They're the people that are most needed to grow food, teach in schools, work in hospitals. Most of them still cannot get access to treatment or to ways, if they're not yet infected, ways to protect themselves from the disease. And it's still gutting communities all over Africa.
Well, you identify so many memorable people, but let's talk about the kids. There's a boy who you write about. He's 12, I think, and he's stuck in grade 3.
Lefa. Yeah, Lefa's really, really mad. When I met him, he was really mad about being in grade 3. Grade 3, as far as Lefa was concerned, had one redeeming feature, was that he had to take home economics. And in home economics, you grow in Lesotho, which is where he lives, a little country in southern Africa, you grow a vegetable garden. And Lefa, it was widely acknowledged, grew the best pumpkins. He grows a really fine pumpkin. So that was good. Everything else about grade 3 really sucks as far as Leif is concerned. And all the other kids every year write the exams and get promoted up a grade, and Leif never does because he's too sick. And every year by the time the exams come around, he's too sick to write them. His parents had both died of HIV, and he was being raised by his grandmother. And kids with HIV, almost, there's 700,000 of them born in Africa every year. It's really simple to prevent that, but it doesn't happen. And so Lefa was born infected. 50% of kids with HIV die before they're 2, and almost all the rest die before they're 5. So when I met Lefa and he was 12, it was miraculous that he was even still alive. And his granny, he was blessed to have a really tough granny who was walking kilometers and kilometers down from the mountains with him to the clinic every time, every couple of weeks, just in the belief that there would finally be something that could be done for him. And the day that about a month before I met him, it had finally come true. She'd gone to the clinic, and this time they'd said, actually, there is something we can do. And pediatric treatment had just started in Lesotho. It's much harder to treat kids with HIV than it is adults for a whole variety of reasons, one of which being that until very recently, there were almost no drugs. Where are the kids with HIV? They're in Africa. Can their parents afford to buy the drugs? No. Therefore, were pharmaceutical companies bothering to make pediatric drugs for pediatric AIDS drugs? No. So mm-hmm. There were no drugs. So there's finally drugs in Lesotho now. And Lefa was incredibly ill, but had been started on the drugs a month earlier. And the doctor told me how that day he couldn't lift his head up. He was drooping over in the arm of the chair. He could barely breathe. He had tuberculosis for the 4th or 5th time. And when I met him a month later, he came running up the hill. He leapt onto the scale in the clinic. He'd gained a couple of kilos. He was running around like a prize fighter, and everyone was cheering when they saw his weight on the scale. I phoned up to the clinic in his village a little while ago, and he's in grade 4 this year.
So he was well enough to write that exam and move forward. That's amazing. Even kids who aren't born with AIDS become victims of AIDS, though. There's so many orphans.
Yeah, so many kids I meet so many teenage girls who have been suddenly handed responsibility for their 9, 7, 5, and 3-year-old siblings. There's this whole phenomenon called serial orphaning, which is, you know, your parents die and you go to your granny, and then your granny dies and you go to your aunties, and then the aunties die and you go to the neighbors, and eventually the neighbors die. And sooner or later, these kids end up in what they call child-headed households, which is a very bland term that doesn't really convey how bizarre it is to go into these little houses and see the 9-year-old who's in charge. And these kids are so valiant, you know, like they have the oldest kid kind of remembers mom and dad and remembers what it's supposed to be like. And so we're supposed to wash our uniforms before we go to school, and we're supposed to sweep in here, and you're supposed to go to bed when it gets dark, and don't scratch, and there's this kind of list of things that you're supposed to do, blow your nose in your sleeve. And they're trying to, in this kind of half-remembered way, trying to parent these younger kids. And the ones who just break my heart are the older girls who, when you sit down with them, like they just, you know, they're keeping this kind of stiff upper lip and holding it all together, but they talk about the things that they wanted to go and do. And they, you know, they wanted to go to high school or go to hairdressing school or all these things that they were supposed to get to do that they can't do anymore. And they have this, like, you can see the kind of weight of the worry on their shoulders.
What's it like to meet people like that and to go on to another story and meet more people like that? What's it like to be surrounded and consumed by that story?
I mean, I guess the thing that makes it
possible to keep doing it is that I meet those kids and they break my heart. And then I go, you know, the next day or the day after, I'll go meet someone, like I'll go spend time with someone like my friend Spiwe in Swaziland or my friend Winston in Zambia. And those people are in the book because they're so brave, and they, you know, they were both some of the first people in their countries to say that they had HIV. And Winston went on Good Morning Zambia in the early 1990s and said he had HIV when nobody in all of Southern Africa would say they had HIV. I guess it's sort of, there's two strands of stories, right? Like there's the stories that I try to tell in the Globe that I want to help people understand how it got this way. What were the economic and the political factors that have gone into making this worse? And then there's also, I try when I can to tell stories like Dr. Lydia, because I want people to know that Africans have responded to this themselves.
A lot of the people who you chronicle in this, then they survive. They go on. They keep working. They're activists. It's not actually a depressing story. It's quite inspirational.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Anna Maria Tremonti was speaking with Stephanie Nolan about her book, 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. The book is published by Knopf Canada and is one of the nominees for this year's Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. And finally today, the fate of nature's songbirds is threatened. But there's hope. Dr. Bridget Stutchbury prescribes ways to save our feathered neighbors from oblivion. It's in her book, Silence of the Songbirds, How We Are Losing the World's Songbirds and What We Can Do to Save Them. She's a professor at York University and a Canada Research Chair in Ecology and Conservation Biology. Dr. Stutchbury spoke last spring with Bob MacDonald on the CBC radio program Quirks and Quarks.
Let's start with the good news here up front. It is spring. The birds are back. It's a great sign. The songs are in the air. If I was to go to the nearest piece of forest, which I guess for me would be a city park, what would I see in the trees?
Oh, you definitely see are the robins who are amongst the first back. And if you're near any patch of wetlands or a ditch, you'd likely to see red-winged blackbirds and song sparrows. They're some of the first birds that come back. These first arriving birds don't come very far. They don't spend their winters in the tropics. Our tropical birds aren't quite back yet.
Ah, when do they arrive?
They'll be back in about a week or two. Mm-hmm. Some of the first birds will be your black-throated green warblers and blue-headed vireos. They're the ones that can stand the cold temperatures that still arrive in April.
How far have some of these birds come?
Some of them have come all the way from Brazil. So some of the thrushes that nest in our boreal forest and the Canada warbler that nests in our boreal forest, they're coming from South America. So at least 6,000 kilometers one way.
And that's just, and this is something you can hold in your hand.
These are tiny little birds. They're not much bigger than a couple of loonies in your hand.
Now, what kind of numbers are we talking about when we say migrating birds coming up?
The numbers are still astounding, so that's the good news. There are still billions of songbirds that pour into Canada every spring.
Billions with a B.
Billions with a B. We call Canada's boreal forest is the songbird nursery of North America. That's where all the action is.
Well, that's all very spectacular and everything, but your book is called The Silence of the Songbirds. So what's your message?
The message is, unfortunately, although we still have billions of birds and are thankful for that, there are over 24 species of our migratory songbirds that have been declining for a long time. We have good records going back to the 1960s. And for a lot of these species, when we look at the numbers, we see this horrible year after year after year drop in numbers, not just for one species, not just for two or three or four. It's at least 24. So we have like a systemic crash in our migratory bird numbers that has been going on for 40 years now.
How much of a decline are you talking about?
For some species, we've lost 50% of the numbers.
Wow.
In just 40 years. So this includes birds like wood thrush, eastern kingbirds, Swainson's thrushes, Canada warblers. I could go on and on. Long list of these beautiful birds. And a lot of them have lost 30 to 50% compared with the early 1960s.
Now, you're focusing on the migrating songbirds. Why that concern?
I chose to focus on migrating songbirds because they spend so much of their lives outside of Canada. They spend 6 or 7 months of the year living on islands in the Caribbean or the beautiful forests in Panama or the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. And they face huge problems on their wintering grounds. And one of the reasons that we're losing our birds is because of what's happening to them when they're not home with us.
Such as?
These birds are losing, a lot of them use tropical rainforest for wintering habitat. And the rates of forest loss in places like Brazil are enormous. They're cutting down their forests at the highest rate ever seen in the history of mankind. So much of it has been cut that our migratory birds are having a hard time finding good habitat for the winter. And they find themselves, instead of a lush rainforest, out in some scrubby, hot, dry patch of vegetation. And that might be okay for a couple months, but in the tropics, the dry season comes along. January, February, it doesn't rain much. And especially for birds that eat insects all winter, they run out of food.
Okay, well, take me on that trip from Brazil back up to here. What are some of the challenges they're going to face along the way, providing they made it through the winter?
One of the first challenges is just getting enough food in their system to store up fat. When birds fly, their jet fuel is the fat that they pack on. So along the way, they need safe habitats to land in, forests or marshes, where they can find enough food to build up enough fat to make the next leg of their journey. And I think in a lot of places, if you imagine the south coast of the United States, a huge housing developments and booms in sizes of cities, and that's precisely where birds land when they first arrive in North America. Most of them fly across the Gulf of Mexico. It's a 14, 16-hour journey nonstop. And when they arrive finally near land, what do they find? Houses and tiny little woodlots. And really, it's a serious problem that they take a long time finding enough food to be able to continue their journey. And the trip across the Gulf, if they run out of energy halfway across, they're going to go in the drink, land in the water.
And they're not ducks. They don't swim.
They don't swim very well or for very long.
Okay.
One of the reasons they come all the way up here is because there's so much food in the summer. We know how annoying it is to have all those mosquitoes and black flies and insects all over us. The wonders of this part of the world in the summer for birds is just the super abundance of bugs. The farther north you go, the more bugs you get. And the insects that are up here are just ripe for the taking. The caterpillars galore, bugs galore.
Are you optimistic that the songbirds can actually be saved, that we won't drive them to extinction?
I am very optimistic because I think half the battle is just convincing people that there's a problem, sort of like global warming. Once you know there's a problem, then people are more willing to jump in and take action. And the number one thing we need to do collectively is to save their habitat. Now, let's save the boreal forest. We don't have to cut it all down. Let's be careful what kind of toilet paper we buy. You know, we can buy toilet paper that's made from recycled paper. It's a simple thing we can do, and it does make a big difference. So I think if we work hard to save the habitats that our birds use, we can feel very optimistic about the future.
In the meantime, there still are billions of them working their way north. When's the peak time to see songbirds?
The peak time for these migratory songbirds is the first 2 weeks of May. They just come back en masse.
So what will you be doing this peak season?
I'll be catching birds.
Well, good luck, and thank you so much for the book and telling us all about it.
Thank you.
Bob McDonald, host of the CBC radio program Quirks and Quarks, speaking with Bridget Stuchbury about her book, Silence of the Songbirds, How We Are Losing the World's Birds and What We Can Do to Save Them. It's published by HarperCollins. And it's the final nominee for this year's Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. Winners in all the award categories will be announced on Tuesday, November the 27th. You should check out our podcast next week when we take a peek at some of the other GG contenders in drama, poetry, and fiction. And speaking of next week, the finalist in the CBC Writing Challenge for Witty Canadians will hit the airwaves on November 20th through the 22nd. It's called Canada Writes, where 5 regional winners gather in Toronto to compete live on air in front of judges and a national audience. There are timed writing exercises as well as points for performance.
you can listen in and even play online. For more information, go to their website at cbc.ca/CanadaRights. You're listening to the Words at Large podcast. If you're not already there, take a look at the rest of our website. This week, we have an online interview with author D.R. MacDonald about his new book, Lachlan of the Bad Heart. And there's a blog from GG nominee David Cherryandy. He's just published his first novel, and now he's up for his first award. Just go to cbc.ca/wordsatlarge to read about it. That's it for the podcast this week. It's produced by Heather Brown. The executive producer, Susan Feldman. I'm Sharon Farrell. We'll be back with another podcast next week.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.